We are joined live in the studios once again by none other than Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of the past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you both here, which is going to be rare because after this week, Maria goes into hibernation.
Yeah, she's heading for the Caribbean for 4 weeks.
No, hardly.
Transfer all the funds to the Cayman accounts.
It's tax season. I'll be doing lot of hours.
Somebody's got to check those Bahama accounts.
That's right. Make sure there's actually real money there as opposed to
just numbers
and zeros.
Yeah, somebody's got to renew the you know, shadow boxes and
numbers have meaning nowadays.
They do.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And
indeed.
Speaking of which, our first item has one of our council members considering collecting some numbers from one of our local projects.
Yeah, Rob Johnson, it turns out, may end up leaving the city council earlier than the end of the year.
He's going to pull a Sally Clark.
Yeah, Johnson had announced that he would not be running for re-election because the mandatory housing affordability legislation, that's the upzones, will be passed this year and fairly soon. The full council is set to vote on that on March 18th. So he said he will have accomplished everything that he set out to do when he ran for council in the first place. As if we didn't already know that Johnson is on the council primarily to serve real estate developers and not very many other people. And the only other thing on Johnson's legislative calendar is a Sound Transit meeting on the West Seattle to Ballard light rail alignment, which is scheduled for April 26th. Erica Barnett says that Johnson pointed that out to her himself. And she has also said on her blog, The C is for Crank, that city council members have been quietly discussing who would replace Johnson if he leaves early. Johnson has already accepted a position with NHL Seattle to advise them on transportation issues once his term has ended. And it could be that he wants that term to end sooner and he wants that nice paying job to start sooner.
Yeah, so this is reminiscent of Sally Clark, who left in, I believe, April of her lame duck year a couple of years ago to take a very cushy six-figure job with the University of Washington. And it really underscores the revolving door that's taking place with some council members with corporate interests locally.
Yeah. Barnett also pointed out in her blog post that if Johnson leaves before the filing deadline of May 17th, then whoever takes his place on the council could file to run for his position in District 4 this coming November. If he leaves after May 17th, that job would just be a temporary one until November, when whoever wins the election for District 4 would be sworn in early, just like happened with Sally Clark.
Yeah. And historically, council has required that those temporary appointments, the people make a commitment not to run for the seat. So yeah. I don't know if they would ask for that for the District 4 position, which already has several very strong candidates running for it, notably Alex Peterson and Sean Scott. So we'll and several others as well. So we'll see what happens with that position or whether somebody else gets an opportunity to jump into the race as a short-term incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
And we should probably wait to see what Amazon wants to.
Yeah.
I'm sure they've already put their order in.
I'm sure they're already behind the scenes whispering in people's ears.
They're going to be fulfilled, I'm sure.
Yeah, that box is being delivered as we speak. All right, moving on, sticking with city council news.
Yeah, the city council this week voted down Shama Sawant's resolution on the human services department director on Monday. The council voted 5-3 and Sawant's resolution would have sent the nomination of Jason Johnson as human services department director back to Mayor Durkin and asked that she revise the hiring process to make it more open and include the input of housing and the HSD, the Human Services Department employees and stakeholders. Sawant, Michael Bryan, and Teresa Mosqueda voted for that resolution. Lisa Herbold, Rob Johnson, Deborah Juarez, Sally Bagshaw, and Lorena Gonzalez voted against, with Bruce Harrell absent. during that meeting. Herbold clearly felt that the mayor has the right to appoint her own department heads, and if the council wanted a more inclusive process, then Sawant should have discussed it with the mayor sooner, preferably early on in the process. Sawant has said that she requested meetings with the mayor several times and that Durkin refused to meet with her. On the other hand, Durkin's aides have said the reverse about Sawant, so I guess it's a question of who do you believe in this situation.
I know who I believe.
Yeah. Mosqueda said that while she felt that the mayor gets, quote, gets to nominate someone and the council gets to run a confirmation process, end quote, she voted for Sawant's proposal because she wants to see a, quote, more inclusive process, end quote, that involves stakeholders too. So Mosqueda, when the resolution...
And we should say in terms of context that Sawant's committee has held a couple of public hearings at which HSD employees, as well as a number of other stakeholders, certainly service providers, have been extremely critical of Johnson's nomination.
Yeah.
And of Johnson's
and
record
of the whole,
as the number two at HSD.
Yeah, and of the whole data, the whole process, the whole switch to base funding on whether on a, one set of data points, that set of data points being exits from homelessness directly into permanent housing, which is not always the best measure of the kind of services that homeless service providers provide to the homeless population. For example, Lehigh is having to shut down its Licton Springs Village, partly because it's reached the 2-year limit for tiny house villages in that area. That's the limit under the city's law. After 2 years, they have to be relocated. But also because the city's been pretty critical of the Licton Springs low barrier village, because the low barrier village accepts anyone who doesn't qualify for other shelter, including folks with drug addiction and alcohol addiction. But in that low barrier shelter, Lehigh's been very successful at other measures of helping those homeless folks, including helping them work towards getting off their addictions, helping them work towards becoming housing ready, which is probably the highest bar for people who are not accepted in other shelters and who have mental health issues in particular. They've been particularly successful at helping people who have lost their identification, getting new identification issued for them so that they can take advantage of other services provided by the Human Services Department. Because without an ID, you're a non-person, literally, especially when it comes to getting services from the system. So,
and a lot of the emergency shelter network in the city of Seattle is dedicated to getting people off the streets, particularly, you know, over the last month or so, where we've had sub-freezing temperatures most nights. That's important too, because it saves lives, but it's not a measure that HSD considers important.
Yeah, the getting people out of doors and indoors is not the measure that HSD is looking at. They're looking at who do you put in permanent housing. And when you base your funding decisions only on one metric and only on that metric, you're missing a whole lot.
Particularly because there's not a whole lot of affordable housing to refer people to.
Mm-hmm. So Mosqueda introduced her own resolution this week to follow on Sawant's resolution, which didn't pass. Mosqueda's resolution would require the mayor to submit information to the council on the recruitment process for new department heads, not ones that are being renewed, but new department heads, including information on which groups are advising the mayor and who sits on those groups. It would require the mayor to provide information to the council on the criteria and process used to identify a nominee, and it would set standards for how the council will evaluate the recruiting process, utilizing the racial equity toolkit and determining whether stakeholders have had a voice in the process. Mosqueda's resolution will not go to a committee, but it will go directly to the full council for consideration on March 18th. That's the same day as the vote on the MHA upzones. Mosqueda's resolution, if it passes, could cause a rift between the council and the mayor. Traditionally, the mayor has always chosen his or her own department heads, and the only oversight that the council has is the confirmation hearing process in a council committee followed by a full council vote. This new resolution would change that and would push the mayor to make the process more open and transparent, and there's going to be considerable pushback from Mayor Durkin and Mayor Durkin's office. Now, remember, this comes after the uproar over the mayor's selection of candidates for the new police chief Durkin initially eliminated the interim chief Carmen Best, then added her back into the mix as the preferred candidate after protests from the community and from folks who have been who had been watching the police reform process. This really called into question Durkin's process for selecting candidates, and it set the stage for the current struggle over Jason Johnson's nomination for HSD director and the transparency in hiring process issue. So in the meantime, Johnson's nomination is headed back to Sawant's committee. She's not likely to move forward on it. And so it's possible, I mean, it's possible that other members of the city council could vote to move the nomination to another committee, but that's extremely rare, seldom been done in the past, and it's not clear that council members would want to do it this time. So right now, Jason Johnson's nomination is in a deadlock.
And I saw this week that Nikita Oliver pointed out that during the mayoral debates before the People's Party that Durkin had signed on to a pledge to incorporate new transparency into her hiring processes and stuff.
She did.
You know, apparently they got that in writing.
Yeah. So holding her to that promise is going to be something that we'll see whether the council can actually do that and follow through, vote on Mosqueda's resolution and see where it goes from there.
So Tim Cease, who is was the deputy mayor under Greg Nichols and was sort of notorious for being an ass, honestly, in those years, he's now the chief lobbyist locally for Amazon, among many other clients. And it'd be very interesting to see how often he's visiting the mayor's office because anecdotally, he's in and out of there quite a bit. So whether that will pop
you
up as part of the
FOIA
transparency process, you know, it'd be even interesting to see.
What is wasn't his nickname under Nichols administration the shark?
That is correct.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Indeed.
And he has landed very comfortably.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Let's move on.
Otherwise, there was a hearing this week regarding Lisa Herbold's bill.
Yeah, council member Lisa Herbold's bill on requiring developers to build one-to-one replacement of affordable housing in five neighborhoods of Seattle had its first hearing this week in Rob Johnson's Land Use Committee. Now, the other members of the committee were skeptical about the need for the bill, as you would expect. Mosqueda pointed to the final environmental impact study for the MHA upzones, which said that demolition of older buildings had only a small impact on displacement. Herbold immediately disagreed with that, saying that the environmental impact statement data was drawn from tenant relocation assistance records, but that only covers people making less than 50% of median income. Folks making from 50 to 80% of median income don't qualify for relocation assistance, so they weren't counted by the environmental impact study as part of the MHA upzones. That cutoff, excuse me, for 50% of median income is $40,100 for a family of two people. So for people who make less than that, they get relocation assistance and they're counted. But if they're between $40,100 and $64,200 for a family of two, they're not counted and they don't qualify for
even though that kind of income still makes it very difficult.
Makes it very difficult to find affordable housing. Yeah. So any household that falls within that range just wouldn't be counted. So Herbold has a point there. And she also pointed to the city council's own statistics on displacement in the university district after the 2017 upzone was passed. The MHA predicted that between 60 to 200 units of affordable housing would be lost over the decade after the upzone was passed in 2017. But only 1 year, a little over a year, has passed already, and already over 90 units have been marked for demolition. So Herbold is saying, look, the MHA upzone, based on that environmental impact statement, way undercounts the number of units lost. There was no vote on her resolution this week, since this is the first discussion of it. Instead, council staffers will evaluate it in terms of its impact on the MHA program and report back to the committee on March 20th. That's 2 days after the final vote on the MHA bill. So Herbold's bill won't be considered side by side with the MHA legislation as she had hoped.
And, you know, Herbold was very specific about why she chose the particular neighborhoods that she did. And you talked about that a couple weeks ago.
I did. Yeah, she chose five neighborhoods because they are at the highest risk for replacement of highest risk for loss of affordable housing with, you know, they're right on. But they still have also the highest number of affordable units left. And they don't include neighborhoods that have been undergoing a lot of gentrification that have been historically places with affordable housing, like the Central District or Beacon Hill or the University District. They include South Park, Rainier Beach, Othello, around the Othello light rail station, and the Highland Park neighborhood, which is just on the very southern border of the city, as well as that small strip in North Seattle between Aurora Avenue North and Greenwood Avenue North from 105th North to 145th, which is the northern city boundary. So those five neighborhoods still have quite a bit of affordable housing in them, and they're just on the point of starting to be gentrified. So she's hoping to preserve that the affordable housing there and not push those people entirely out of the city of Seattle, as has happened with residents of so many other neighborhoods.
Yeah, and that's opposed to the MHA process, which really was dedicated on identifying the neighborhoods that developers find most desirable.
Yeah.
And that again will be voted on a week from Monday.
Yeah.
Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, more developments in Olympia this week?
Yeah, a roundup of bills in the state legislature. Senate Bill 5273, both houses of the state legislature have passed that bill to move Washington State's presidential primary to the second Tuesday in March. Currently, it comes on the fourth Tuesday in May, after many other states have already had their primary votes and many candidates have already dropped out of the race. State Democrats have in prior years completely ignored the primary election altogether and used a caucus system to allocate their delegates. For example, in 2016, Bernie Sanders won the majority of Washington state caucuses on March 26th. But 2 months later, Hillary Clinton then won the primary election.
Yeah, and that was at a point 2 months later where Clinton had really sewn up the nomination.
Yeah, so Washington State Republicans in 2016 abandoned the caucus system and awarded all of their delegates to Trump following the primary. And Trump at that point had pretty much also sewn up the Republican primary, and most other Republican candidates had dropped out. Now, in 2020, the Washington state primary will fall on Tuesday, March 10th, which is just 1 week after Super Tuesday, when 10 states hold their primaries, including California, Massachusetts, Texas, and Virginia, some of the largest states with the largest number of delegates
in the nation. And California, just a few weeks ago, had moved their primary to that Super Tuesday from early June.
Yeah, so that's going to make March, and early March in particular, the decisive time when a lot of candidates will decide whether or not to stay in the race. And it will give Washington state primary a lot more influence and also spur candidates to visit Washington state in order to get our votes. So we'll have a lot more attention from the candidates than we have in past years. Now, the Washington state Democrats will be meeting soon to decide if they will continue to allocate delegates based on the caucus system or if they'll honor the results of the primary now that it falls earlier in the year. And my guess is they may choose to honor the primary because it's less of an expense for them. They won't have to pay a lot of money to set up and run the caucus system and keep track of how the different caucuses voted. And also, it means that people who have to work on the weekends and can't attend a caucus will be able to cast a vote in a primary and have their vote counted. Because traditionally, in primaries, you see anywhere from double the number to triple the number of people voting than you do in caucus participation.
Yeah, and caucus participation tends to measure the candidates who have the most fervent support. Mm-hmm. People who are motivated enough to go out to caucus. And we certainly saw that with Sanders' win in 2016, even though the overall primary support went to Clinton. So it's a way of short-circuiting grassroots candidates. We should also note that the Democrats this time around will be much less reliant on the superdelegates, which were such a controversial part of the 2016 nomination process.
Yes, absolutely. Also this week, Senate Bill 5971. I talked about that a little bit last week as part of the big transportation funding package of three bills. One of those bills covered ways to raise revenue for transportation funding. Senate Bill 5971, as part of that proposal, included a carbon fee. which would have raised quite a bit of money. Now, this week I looked at more details of that bill. The carbon fee of $15 per ton of carbon emissions is actually quite low if you consider the vital need to discourage carbon emissions in the transportation sector, the transportation sector being the largest source of carbon emissions in Washington state. Also, the fact that it doesn't index that and increase that rate until 2027 is something that makes you wonder, well, maybe we should write that in a little bit earlier in the process. Now, the expense side of the bill is also very heavy on road construction, with only 8% of the funding earmarked for multimodal projects, including pedestrian, bicycle, and transit improvements. That's not very much if you want to talk about getting people out of their cars and cleaning up the environment. More importantly, the bill, as originally drafted, it snuck in a provision at the very end that would make permanent the poison pill provision that Republicans included in the 2015 transportation package. That provision says that if the state legislature passes a low carbon fuel standard before the year 2023, then transit projects would lose their state funding. That poison pill was an absolute non-starter for a low carbon fuel standard in the last legislative session. This current transportation bill would remove that wording before 2023 date, making the ban on low carbon fuel standard permanent. That should be a non-starter altogether for this bill. The bill's sponsor, Steve Hobbs, Democrat from the 44th District in Snohomish County, east of Everett, added the provision to win the support of Republicans and big businesses for the bill. But again, it just makes the bill a heavy lift for House Democrats, who are unlikely to support it with the permanent poison pill included. Nevertheless, the bill passed out of the Senate Transportation Committee and has been referred to the Senate Ways and Means Committee, which will look at the fiscal impact of the three bills that make up this transportation funding package. Bob Hasegawa, Reuben Carlisle, and Jamie Peterson all sit on that committee. So I would urge people to call their offices and tell them that you want the poison pill provision repealed altogether, not made permanent, which is what this bill does. Senate Bill 5971.
And that's extremely counterproductive to the overall goal of trying to ameliorate climate change.
Mm-hmm. Again, that's Bob Hasegawa, Reuben Carlisle, and Jamie Peterson. And the bill number is 5971. Now, another bill passed in the legislature this week, and Amazon was involved in that bill. It was Senate Bill 5478. That bill passed the Senate and is now in the House. 5478 is a bill that would protect employees who make under a certain amount of money from non-compete clauses. Non-compete clauses are used by employers to prevent their employees from taking their quote-unquote intellectual property to another competing company, getting a job there, and spilling the company's secrets to their new employer, or starting up their own business utilizing intellectual trade secrets that they got from their previous employer. Now, a lot of employers tend to use those non-compete clauses abusively. So, for example, they will make all their employees at all levels sign them when only a few employees really know the trade secrets of the company. And then that locks all of those employees into working for that employer. They can't just go to a competitor and get a better wage for doing a relatively lower paying job in a company, because the non-compete clause says you can't work for any of our competitors for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. In addition, in the high tech industry, many people can't go without working for years in their trade, because then their skills start to deteriorate fairly quickly. Now, the original bill said that people who should be exempt from signing non-compete clauses are people who make less than three times the average annual wage. That set that limit at people who make under $270,000 could not be forced to sign a non-compete clause as a condition of their employment. It was amended in the Rules Committee.
There's a shock.
Yeah, it was amended in the Rules Committee to two times the average annual wage, or $180,000. And then Amazon said, well, that's great, but we want it even lower. And their lobbyists pushed so that it was amended again on the floor of the Senate for that limit to be lowered to $100,000 plus adjustments by according to the Consumer Price Index annually. So the median salary, I just want to point out to people, the median salary for an Amazon employee in Seattle is $113,000. So this lowered limit from 270,000, where you're, you know, above that limit, you're capturing a lot of people who work as programmers who really would know the intellectual, really know the secrets of the company and have some claim to real serious knowledge of their intellectual trade secrets. It lowers it down to $100,000 and would capture the majority of employees who work within Seattle for Amazon. And that's capturing a lot of employees who have nothing to do with that sort of work. And it really, what it does is it locks them into working for Amazon, working for a lower wage than they might make at another company. And it really is allowing Amazon to use the non-compete clause, non-compete agreements, as really an abusive labor practice against its own employees. But that's Amazon.
You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
You can never leave, yeah. And I also want to point out, too, that the House has been working on a bill, too. And they got a sign-off from Microsoft at a higher wage level, but Amazon was not satisfied with that. So a bill that was okay with Microsoft could not clear the hurdle for Amazon, and they pushed to lower that limit. So that isn't yet another example of how Amazon lobbies state and local governments in order to get exactly what it wants.
But one difference here is that there'd already been like a lot of coverage of Amazon pushing in other states here locally and stuff. So it wasn't like the lawmakers this time around
didn't know,
were ignorant of what was coming down the pike and what they were doing.
No.
They're making a calculation in terms of getting reelected.
Yeah, and getting money from Amazon for their reelection as well. So I also want to get to three other bills that passed the Senate this week and will now move to the House. Senate Bill 5376 to impose a European-style data privacy standard in the state of Washington. That bill would force companies to disclose to consumers the types of data that they collect, allow people to correct inaccurate data or request to have their data deleted, and it would restrict some uses of facial recognition software. Government and law enforcement could not use facial recognition software for ongoing surveillance in public spaces unless they get a court order or a declaration of an emergency. That bill seems to be a really good bill. It's now headed to the House. Senate Bill 5579 is a bill requiring oil companies to process their crude oil and make it less volatile before shipping it through Washington State via train car. The bill's sponsor was Democrat Andy Billig of Spokane, who said that oil trains ship volatile Bakken crude oil through his district within a few hundred yards of schools and residences. He pointed to oil train derailments in the Columbia Gorge in 2016, which caused a fire that burned for 14 hours before it could be extinguished, and the Lac-Mégantic oil train derailment in Canada, which killed 47 people and burned down 30 buildings in 2013, as examples for why this bill is necessary. So that bill has now moved on to the House. And finally, Senate Bill 5811 passed the Senate with a vote of 26 to 22. It would adopt the same vehicle carbon emissions rules that California has, issuing credits to car manufacturers for certain vehicles imported into the state based on the fuel efficiency and the type of fuel that those vehicles use. The state would then set a quota for the number of zero-emission vehicles each manufacturer must bring into the state for sale. The quota would not be very high to begin with. The goal is that 2.5% of the cars imported into Washington should be zero emission vehicles, and the state could then adjust that quota over time. So that looks like it is also on its way to the House.
Didn't the state pass a bill a few years ago requiring the state's fleet of vehicles to reach certain levels of zero emissions?
Yeah.
And the state really hasn't followed through on that.
Well, it depends. There are some departments that have and some that haven't. And there are some cities and municipalities within the state that are working on their own such rules. But this bill is supposed to target car manufacturers and the entire transportation market, not just whether state agencies or city or municipalities are doing it. That's a very, very limited. That's a very, very limited.
Yes, I'm just wondering if such a limited bill really hasn't gotten consistently enforced. I'm wondering about the enforcement provisions for this one.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know how often the poison pill option is woven into legislation.
It depends.
How often are Republicans involved?
Well, or lobbyists with throwing around a lot of money.
Mm. All right. Anything else on that?
We're right around in the midpoint of the show today, and I just want to point out to people that if you enjoy listening to Eat the Airwaves,
or at least appreciate it. Maybe enjoyment is the wrong word.
On KODX, then we could use your support. We're an all-volunteer station, and this is an all-volunteer show, and we have bills to pay. So if you would like to show your support, please go to our website, kodxseattle.org, and click on the Patreon button and become a regular supporter of KODX and Eat the Airwaves. Yeah. Or you can send us a check. You can make it out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, zip code 98145.
Yeah, anybody who has followed the saga of independent media over the past few years knows how important it is to, you know, have those of us who care about these issues actually own the media outlets that we use, because otherwise you're subject to... You know, corporate censorship, basically. And KODX is a nonprofit. It is operated by people who care in the community, who care about these issues. It's all news and public affairs. And if you find this information valuable, by all means, help us stay alive. KODXseattle.org is the website.
That's right. And we just saw Seattle Weekly throw in the towel here. A week back, I think it was.
Yeah,
which is, you know, as somebody who wrote for the Weekly for a number of years, that was very sad to see. They've accomplished a lot with a skeleton staff for the past couple of years, but even that apparently was not sustainable.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's move on to national and talk about 47 months.
Yeah, Paul Manafort sentenced to 47 months, nine of which have already been served. Judge Elliott in the Eastern Virginia District made that ruling, and did so due to Manafort's, quote, having lived an otherwise blameless life, which kind of tells you where Judge Elliott is coming from. This is a man, of course, who basically has spent his entire adult life advising dictators around the world, starting with Ferdinand Marcos in the 1980s and working his way through much of sub-Saharan Africa and on to Viktor Yanukovych in the Ukraine for the last 10 years or so. And, you know, the Manafort's lawyers, after that ruling, made a point in their audience of one to say, oh, the judge didn't say anything about collusion with Russia. Well, no, he didn't say anything about, you know, premeditated murder either, because that wasn't part of the charges against Manafort. They involved tax fraud, money laundering, and so forth. Which were extremely extensive and involved some $55 million that Manafort tried to shield from the IRS. But, you know, he actually is guilty of murder. 150 or so Ukrainian protesters that on his order were basically murdered by the Yanukovych regime in the Ukraine in 2013 is just one example of his otherwise blameless life. And, you know, there's a lot of other things, not even in his work life, that raise questions about, you know, he may not have been violating the law, but certainly not a blameless life in terms of his personal life and personal dealings as well. But that isn't the final word, because Manafort's second sentencing will be held this coming Wednesday. That's in Judge Amy Jackson's federal court in D.C. She is likely to be a little more stringent. That is the court where Manafort violated the plea agreement with Robert Mueller's team and where questions of collusion did in fact come up in terms of his lying about his meetings with Konstantin Kalimnik, his former business partner in the Ukraine, and according to the FBI, a GRU intelligence agent for Russia. So that was the meeting at which Manafort allegedly gave over internal data for a polling data from the Trump campaign that potentially was used by Russia in its targeting of its social media campaign to influence the election in 2016. So we'll see what the sentencing looks like next Wednesday, whether the additional years that are tacked on to Manafort's sentence are consecutive or concurrent. And the sentencing by Judge Elliott was decried by a lot of former prosecutors and a lot of retired judges as being a real aberration. It was about one quarter of the original sentencing guidelines of 19 to 24 years for those particular crimes. And a lot of people thought that that was a miscarriage of justice.
Yeah, especially in comparison to what regular folks get, you know.
Yeah, people who aren't white and doing white-collar crime and having the most expensive lawyers.
So, but that wasn't all that happened this week.
Oh, no, there was quite a few other things in Trump land. Bill Shine, the president's sixth communications director, resigned abruptly yesterday. He's shuffled off to the Trump reelection campaign after Gene Meyer's excellent New Yorker article earlier this week on the nexus between Donald Trump and Fox News, and basically the revolving door and how dependent Trump is on Fox News for advice, much more so than his actual advisors, not counting Putin, Sean Hannity and Fox News are and Fox and Friends are his most important domestic advisors for policy, which ought to terrify anybody who's ever seen the misinformation that comes out of Fox News. But that is an excellent piece of reporting by Jane Meyer in The New Yorker. I would highly recommend people go and read that article if you really want to be depressed about what kind of information Trump is relying on for his ideas. But Bill Shine is being shuffled off as communications director. Meanwhile, the White House has refused the House Oversight Committee's request for information on security clearance, the process for security clearance for Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. But the committee, it turns out, had already received leaked documents from somebody in the White House about how those security clearances took place against the recommendations of the FBI, CIA, and other intelligence agencies. Apparently, though, Trump overrode those initial denials of security clearances for Ivanka and Jared. Kushner has allegedly given dissident lists to MBS in Saudi Arabia and excluded U.S. staffers from his latest meeting with MBS, which happened just this past week. Of course, Kushner is heavily reliant on Saudi financing for his own real estate empire in New York, which is heavily in debt. So there's real questions about corruption and about quid pro quos there for Jared's personal business dealings and whether he's using U.S. secrets and U.S. intelligence to trade on that and get personal benefits for it. It's something that various House committees are almost certain to be looking at.
And I have the list here.
Oh, go for it.
Five House committees that are looking into Trump's affairs. The Judiciary Committee, which has the ability to start the impeachment proceedings, have been looking into his affairs, and they questioned Michael Cohen last week.
Yeah, and that's chaired by Jerry Nadler of New York.
Yeah, the Oversight and Reform Committee, which Jav just talked about, I think alone this week they issued 81 requests, separate requests for documents from the Trump administration. They have a very broad mandate. They're essentially ethical oversight is their mission. They are currently looking into the Stormy Daniels payoff and the security clearances of Trump's family members, but they can also look into everything from his border policy to how the Trump administration is conducting the 2020 census to the misconduct by various cabinet members. And so we can expect to see them kind of jump around from topic to topic, but they can look into all different aspects of the Trump administration.
Yeah. And Chair Elijah Cummings is very, very sharp. And if you go through those lists,
he's
of 80,
great.
His list of document requests, it's really a laundry list of pretty much every scandal dating back to Trump's inauguration.
Yeah.
He's been taking very careful notes over the past couple of years. And unable to do anything about it because the previous Republican chair of that committee, Trey Gowdy, simply wouldn't move forward on any of these investigations. But now with the Democrats in charge, as Maria said, they have a very broad mandate, and Cummings is using that power, very broadly. He's taken very careful notes.
Now, the third committee that's looking into all this is the Intelligence Committee. They are looking into Trump's foreign connections, particularly in terms of Russia and Saudi Arabia, to see if that's influencing him in any way. The fourth committee is the Ways and Means Committee. They are digging into Trump's tax returns. They have the ability to basically request and get the tax returns of any citizen in the United States, and they are now looking at getting the tax returns for Donald Trump. So we will eventually get to see those, I'm sure.
Yeah, Ways and Means is where the budget starts also. So they have a lot of power.
Finance is there.
The Intelligence Committee under Adam Schiff of California has also been very aggressive in its investigation.
Yeah, and then finally, the Foreign Affairs Oversight and Intelligence Committee. The Foreign Affairs Committee is concerned with how the Trump administration is conducting its foreign affairs. And as Jav pointed out, Donald Trump doesn't take the advice of anybody, really, except maybe Fox News, and goes his own way.
And Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, and Vladimir Putin. And so they are looking at directly at Trump's meetings with Putin, and especially his so-called secret conversations, where he would make all of the other members of his U.S. delegation leave the room and leave just him and Putin and one of Putin's translators to talk about issues in secret. The Foreign Affairs Committee is very concerned about what went on in those meetings, and they're trying to get documents written by any of the other members of those teams who may have taken directions from Trump right after his meetings with Putin, to try to get a sense of what was discussed.
Yeah, and tellingly, nobody else in Trump's cabinet actually knows what went on in those meetings either.
Yeah.
Trump has been kept there very secret, to the point of swearing U.S. translators to secrecy about what went on in those meetings and destroying their notes.
And and I'm sure that those translators will be called to testify before
Absolutely.
The Foreign Affairs Committee on these things.
Yep. So a lot of entertaining TV coming up on C-SPAN in the coming weeks.
Yeah.
Well, we still have C-SPAN.
Yes.
All right. Moving on. H.R. 1.
Yeah, H.R. 1 passed along party line votes yesterday. No, it was it yesterday or Thursday?
On Friday.
It was on Friday.
Mm-hmm. It's 234 to 193 was the vote.
It's called the For the People Act, and it's a very broad-ranging piece of legislation, essentially trying to restore voting rights to everyone in the country.
Yeah, it includes campaign finance disclosure as well. The bill would require super PACs and nonprofit organizations who spend on elections, either in support of candidates or to support specific issues, they would be required to disclose the names of their donors who gave more than $10,000. The bill would also deal with campaign finance matching. It would allow congressional and presidential candidates who refuse to take big sums of money to get a 6-to-1 match for contributions up to $200. It would open up voting access, as Job mentioned. It would designate Election Day as a federal employment holiday, automatically register citizens to vote, and restore voting rights to felons who've served their time. It would also prohibit voter roll purges. And it would involve ethics law changes. It would require candidates for federal office to release 10 years of their federal income tax returns. And it would require inaugural committees to disclose the details of their expenses. It would also prohibit the federal government from spending federal funds on any business owned by the president, the vice president, or any cabinet official. It would also require the Department of Defense to report to Congress on the cost of the president's travel, and it would prevent political appointees from spending federal funds on travel on private jets and other private transportation.
And my favorite, and that one certainly aimed at Trump's cabinet members, but there's also a ban on most first-class air travel for federal office holders.
Uh-huh. So most of these, as Job said, are jabs at Donald Trump and the corruption within his cabinet, where more members have been investigated for corruption than in any previous administration, at least in the modern era. The voting access changes really are designed to respond to Republican efforts to make it harder for poor and minority citizens to vote, because, of course, those folks usually support Democrats when they do get to the polls. And the campaign finance measures are meant to fight the influx of hidden spending in federal elections since the Supreme Court ruled in the Citizens United case that corporations must be allowed to spend as much as they want on elections. In other words, money equals free speech. H.R. 1 now says that that speech must be public speech if money equals free speech. And, of course, I want to look at H.R. 1's chances in the Senate. Right now, they're slim to none. Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico said back in December that he will introduce a Senate companion bill once H.R. 1 passes the House. But, of course, no Republicans have stepped forward to co-sponsor or support a Senate version, and they hold the majority in the Senate. Instead, Democrats—
And McConnell has already been clear that he will not allow the H.R. 1 to come to the Senate for a vote.
Yeah, instead, Democrats in the Senate are really playing the long game here. They're looking towards hoping to win a majority of seats in 2020 in the Senate, after which they'll pass a companion bill in 2021. So that's the timeline we're looking at here.
And hopefully have a Democrat in the White House who can sign the bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
And the idea of trying to be able to force Republicans to take a stand on that bill in time for the 2020 election.
Yeah,
that's certainly important.
The Democrats can use that as a reason for people to vote for Democratic candidates and against Republicans because they're against ethics and expanding voter rights.
All right. Also this week, developments with immigrants seeking asylum.
Yeah, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals extended habeas corpus rights to immigrants seeking asylum. This was a historic ruling this week, and it ruled that immigrants who failed their initial intake interview before an immigration judge are entitled to a hearing in a federal court before being deported from the United States. Intake hearings sometimes last only a few minutes. During that short time, an immigrant seeking asylum must prove a credible fear of persecution if returned to their country of origin. Often the judge does not speak the same language as the immigrant, and translators are not always available or even reliable, especially if the immigrant speaks an indigenous language instead of Spanish, or is from a country or an area of the world that was never colonized by England or Spain or the United States.
And this has been a huge issue with Guatemalan refugees in recent years.
Many of them from rural areas where the main language is an indigenous language, not Spanish. This ruling applies only to the states within the Ninth Circuit, Washington, Oregon, California, Hawaii, and Arizona, so only those five states. And because it conflicts with a ruling in the Third Circuit Court that denied federal court hearings to asylum seekers, it will eventually go to the Supreme Court for resolution.
And you know, we've been around long enough to remember during the Bush administration when the U.S. first started denying habeas corpus to different people. This used to be a standard for court proceedings in the U.S. for anybody, citizen or not. But the kind of precedent that's set by these
discrimination is alive and well, and it is institutional discrimination
this
case.
And once that precedent is set, it's built upon and expanded to include all kinds of disadvantaged constituencies. In this case, asylum-seeking immigrants.
Yeah.
So this hopefully will be something that the Supreme Court can rule on favorably.
Yeah.
I'm not optimistic on that, but it would be good to do.
Yeah. Now, in just some numbers here, in 2018, more than 99,000 immigrants requested asylum in the United States. About 55% of those were at the southern border with Mexico. But of those 99,000, only 15% were allowed into the U.S., about half the rate of the previous year. The Trump administration has been doing its best to deny asylum by narrowing the criteria for granting asylum, by limiting the number of people who can apply for it each day, in other words, metering, at the border, and by forcing asylum seekers to wait in camps across the southern border in Mexico while their cases wind through the courts in the U.S.
Yeah, camps that are often very unsafe.
Yeah, or unsanitary. Now, this ruling will change that dynamic for a significant number of people. So this is very, very good news. And we'll see eventually how the Supreme Court rules.
All right. Also this week, more lawsuits.
Yeah, three more lawsuits were filed this week over the
you
new...
You can say that every week, can't you?
I know.
Well,
you're going to pre-record it.
Yeah, this time over the new Health and Human Services rule that prohibits family planning and reproductive health care clinics and doctors from referring women to abortion providers, these providers who take Title X funding from the federal government for family planning services provided to poor women. This is now being referred to as the gag rule. This new rule would force doctors to give patients a list of primary care providers, but not to tell them which names on the list, if any, provide abortion services. In other words, a doctor, if a woman asks for where can I terminate this pregnancy, the doctor could give her a list of primary care family planning providers, and not a single one of them may be a provider who provides abortion services.
Yeah, and once again, this is very much aimed at Planned Parenthood,
yeah,
which is a primary provider of women's reproductive health care for a lot of the country.
Yeah, now the rule would also force family planning providers to perform abortions in separate facilities from their other services and to keep a separate set of books. This is financially prohibitive for most family planning clinics and family planning providers to do, to build or set up an entirely separate facility and to split off their accounting into a second separate department. Also, the gag rule does not require providers to discuss all family planning options with their patients, and that opens the door for the very first time for anti-abortion groups to receive federal funding under Title X for so-called comprehensive family planning services. Now, first off, Planned Parenthood joined with the American Medical Association to file a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court in Oregon on behalf of an estimated 4 million female patients who rely on Title X funding for their health care through Planned Parenthood clinics. Many clinics, as I said, would be forced to shut down because they can't handle the financial burden of separating their abortion services from their other reproductive health care services. Then California filed its 47th lawsuit against the Trump administration this week, again against the new gag rule in federal court in San Francisco. They said that about 1 in 4 women who benefit from Title X money live in California, and more than half of those women earn less than the federal poverty level. California estimates that for every $1 spent in family planning for poor women, the state saves $7 in Medicaid-related costs. And then Oregon led a coalition of 21 states this week in filing suit against the gag rule, this time in U.S. District Court in Eugene. So, of course, the goal of all these lawsuits, and I talked last week about Washington State filing our own lawsuit against the gag rule too. Now, the goal of all these separate lawsuits is to get a federal court to issue an injunction that would stop the rule from taking effect about 55 days from now.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of all of these lawsuits are based in the Ninth District.
Yeah, now the more different lawsuits that are filed, the more likely one of those lawsuits will be heard. And it doesn't really matter which one gets heard first. Hopefully, the one that's heard first will spark the injunction. At least one of those, hopefully, will prevail and take effect in time to stop the new rule before it goes into effect.
All right. And finally, trade deficits.
Yeah, Donald Trump spent a lot of time in 2016 talking about how he was going to restore American manufacturing and erase the trade deficit with China and so on and so forth. And new trade numbers that came out this week put the lie to that. They are a record overall trade deficit of some, I believe,
$891.3 billion.
Yeah, that was it. And then 400 some billion dollars with China alone. So the tariff war that Trump has initiated with China in particular has led to that outcome. And then also a very stagnant economy overall. Experts had expected with a jobs report that came out this week that some 180,000 new jobs would have been added in February. That number was only 20,000 new jobs nationally, which breaks down to about 400 per state.
We should point out that the number of new jobs added each month needs to be over 100,000 in order for the economy just to stay at its current level, not for the economy to grow. So when you see only 20,000 jobs added, that's a setback for the economy, and it points to a major slowdown potentially.
Yeah. And we'll see whether that's an outlier with coming months' job numbers, but it's certainly a warning sign.
Yeah.
And are those full-time jobs? I mean, are we assuming they...
That's a good question. My guess is that they're looking at full-time equivalent jobs here, but that's not always the case.
And we don't know how much these jobs are paying either. So,
because
there's plenty of people that have multiple jobs now to try and survive.
Yeah, and the federal government has played fast and loose with numbers before on those kind of job reports.
Yeah, and I want to point out too that Donald Trump had bragged when he was first elected that he would reduce the trade deficit to zero. That's what he said. He would get rid of the trade deficit entirely. And he bragged again when his tax law was passed that it would reduce the trade deficit. And when he started up a trade war with China and Europe and Mexico and Canada, he bragged that his trade wars would reduce the trade deficit. And none of those things have done that. They've done exactly the reverse. Even though economists had told him that they would do exactly the reverse, he still lied and said, oh, no, they're going to reduce the trade deficit.
Yeah,
well, here's the actual numbers.
Fox and Friends said that it would work. So,
well, I think even Fox and Friends looked at the data and said, no, I think it's going to make the trade deficit worse in some ways. And,
it does not take a degree in economics to predict it. It really doesn't.
No, it takes someone with a functioning brain. And I think that's where we're at with this current president, is that you really have to question whether or not his brain is working the way it should be.
All right. Events.
Yeah. Coming up on Sunday, tomorrow, there will be a fifth anniversary party for NWDC resistance that will be down in Tacoma at the Northwest Detention Center. Temporary home of a number of detained asylum seekers. That is at 1623 J Street in Tacoma, just east of downtown. A week from today, Saturday, March 16th, from 2:30 to 5:30 in the afternoon, there will be a hands-off Venezuela rally at Seattle Central College Plaza, Pine and Broadway on Capitol Hill. And then on Sunday, next weekend, from 1 to 2:30, the 13th Annual Urban Poverty Forum. That will be also on Capitol Hill at Hugo House, 1634 11th Avenue in Seattle. So go check those items out. And then, as we mentioned earlier in the show also, a week from Monday, on the 18th, City Council will be having a couple of important votes, particularly on the MHA upzoning for 27 different neighborhoods, which would completely remake the face of Seattle in a way that people now can recognize from what's happened to South Lake Union and U District. So that's going to be a critical vote, and we'll see how that turns out a week from Monday. If you want to contact your City Council person before then, now would be an excellent time to do that.
Yes, well, you still recognize the names versus the 48 candidates that are running for those positions.
Yes, which we'll talk about in the coming weeks as the primary starts to get closer.
All right. And we want to remind people that you're listening to KODXLP, 96.9 Seattle.
And if you support KODX and want to support us financially, because we're an all-volunteer station and we do rely on listener support.
We do need your support.
Please visit kodxseattle.org and click on the Patreon button to become a regular supporter of KODX.
And what's that address for people who want to actually use the mail?
People who are out there want to write a check, you can make it out to Earth on the Air, Independent Media. Send it to P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Yes. We appreciate all your donations and support. Yes.
And thank you so much to the people who've already sent in.
To the people who have already decided to support us.
We had someone become a Patreon supporter while we were speaking today. So
thank you.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Yes.